What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Jesse Strauss. As we've done just about every Monday since October of last year, Law and Disorder returns to our recurring segment, The Palestine Post, discussing the latest news from Israel's genocide in Gaza and on their border regions, and the efforts that people are taking around the world to stop it. On today's show, we'll start in conversation with two healthcare workers who've been on medical missions to Gaza, one of whom also recently returned from a mission to Lebanon after Israel's bombing campaign there. We're joined by Bridget Rochios, a registered nurse and women's health practitioner and nurse midwife in the Bay Area. Bridget traveled to Gaza in May to volunteer at a maternity hospital, and since then she's faced consequences at her local job for wearing a Palestine pin. Bridget, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
We're happy to have you on. We're also joined by Dr. Mohammed Soubeh, a Palestinian-American emergency room doctor at El Camino Hospital in Mountain View. He recently returned home from Beirut, Lebanon, his third medical mission to the region in the past year, to provide emergency medical care amid Israel's various bombardments. Dr. Soubeh, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Dr. Soubeh, I want to start with you. You very recently returned from a medical mission to Lebanon. I'm wondering, because we've heard a lot and we've discussed a lot of the news of Israel's bombardments in Lebanon, we haven't really been able to receive reports from the ground. I'm wondering if you can describe what kinds of care did you see that were needed there in Beirut? And since you've been to Gaza also in the past year a few times, if you could describe the differing conditions.
Yeah, so I was based out of a town called Siblin in southern Lebanon, about maybe half the distance between Beirut and the border of South Lebanon. There we managed mass casualty incidents similar to what we did in Gaza, where we would get surges of trauma patients after a missile strike or bombardment of residential buildings. And, you know, at Lebanon, for folks who don't know, is under a lot of economic strain since 2019. And this has just compounded the difficulties there on the ground for the civilian population. Much of the similar pages of the playbook that Israel used in Gaza was used in Lebanon, southern Lebanon, namely around healthcare infrastructures, bombing healthcare facilities. About four or five hospitals in southern Lebanon were out of commission because of bombardments. And if they're not bombing the hospitals, they're bombing the roads leading up to hospitals. Whereas Gaza is largely a flat terrain, Lebanon is very mountainous. So in order to reach the hospitals on the hilltops, folks need to take windy roads up, and they would bomb those roads. It would also target many of our colleagues in the EMS, the ambulances, the EMS crews, making it difficult for folks to get quick attention that they need in these traumatic events. All in all, it was extremely difficult. Just like Gaza, had many similarities, but also, you know, many differences, where we were able to get supplies in without going through a military blockade, irrational reasons for not allowing oxygen concentrators to enter, ultrasounds, or things that are critical to our work, especially in the emergency setting.
And then briefly, I'm wondering if you can describe your choice on why you made the choice to go on this medical mission to Lebanon in a context having fairly recently, visited in a similar capacity Gaza.
Lots of different reasons. One, first and foremost, as a humanitarian, it doesn't matter where the need is. My goal is to always use the privileges that have been given to me to help human beings around the world. I think if we look at all of the spots where human beings are really struggling right now, there is an epicenter in this region. And a lot of it is man-made. And I see kind of the types of atrocities that are committed against human beings. The other piece of this, I mean, you have over a million human beings that were displaced from the South, with their villages completely obliterated in the span of a month and a half or so. And all of those folks not only needed, addressing their traumatic injuries, but, managing their chronic conditions. They were sheltering in schools, lack of access to proper nutrition, all of these things that if you don't address them when they're, on a small scale, say a million and a half people, these boil over and affect entire regions and an entire world, whether it be, related to nutrition or infectious disease, like we saw, not long ago with the COVID pandemic. So I think it's important, first and foremost, as human beings, to see how we can help our fellow human beings. And that's kind of where this is all rooted for me personally. And then secondly, see where you can have the highest impact.
Well, I think this conversation about also, in addition to treating wounds effects of bombings and attacks, it's also important to discuss just the regular hospital visits that people make. And I think this is a perfect way to bring Bridget into the conversation. Bridget, you went to Gaza on a medical mission in May to volunteer at a maternity hospital. When I think of that work, that trip was about 7 months after Israel's genocide started in Gaza. And when we're talking about maternal care, that's most of a gestational term. Certainly, we've been much longer than that since then. But what kinds of medical needs were you seeing in your time in Gaza as they relate to ongoing hospital care?
Yeah, I think that there's not one thing that was not needed. By the time that I arrived in Gaza in May, essentially none of my patients had received prenatal care, and there was very limited obstetric care that they received. We were running out of supplies at the time, and things only got worse a week after I arrived, when Rafah border crossing was besieged and closed, which effectively ended all kind of aid into Gaza and all humanitarian aid rotations for at least a month. I think it's like really important to think about the fact that nearly half of the population in Gaza are women and girls, and nearly half of the population is also children. And 70% of the verified dead over the last 14 months have been women and girls, mostly between the ages of 5 and 9 years old. So it's very clear kind of how deeply this genocide is affecting, women and young girls. What I saw were patients who were incredibly malnourished, who had babies that were born too small, who were really dehydrated. And dehydration is one thing in pregnancy, which is not great, but it also really significantly impacts infant feeding. So, women would go home only a few hours after giving birth because of the limitations of the size and the capacity of the hospital. I was at Emirati Maternity Hospital in Rafah, which is a very small but mighty maternity hospital. It was the only one operating in the Strip at the time that I was there. But it was built to serve a population of like 300,000 people in Rafah. And by the time I entered, there was over a million people there. And so it was bursting at the seams. And with limited resources and hospital beds, 2 hours after delivery, women would go home. And really not have a straightforward plan for infant feeding, as like breastfeeding requires a well-nourished and hydrated mother, and bottle feeding requires access to clean water, which was limited, and formula, which is incredibly expensive if you're able to find it.
So these are conditions that you're describing from May. I'm wondering if, since you've been in Gaza, have you been able to stay in touch with some of the maternity care providers that you were working with, and how conditions may have changed, developed, or gotten worse since you were there in May?
Definitely. I think, again, it's really important to think about the Rafah border crossing closing in May, because when I entered Gaza in May, there was a large delegation of healthcare workers that came in with me. All of us carried in multiple bags of supplies. And at that point, the only way kind of consistent medical aid and like medical supplies getting into Gaza were on the backs of international healthcare workers. The director of the organization that I went with, Glia, mentioned it kind of as like a straw at the time. You know, it was one little straw of air coming into Gaza as Israel was blockading all other forms of humanitarian aid and healthcare. With the closure of that border, that straw was totally removed and it really suffocated the healthcare system. At this point, you know, the only way that folks are getting in or supplies are getting in is through a border crossing controlled by Israel. So what that means is that delegations, my delegation that went in was like nearly 60 healthcare workers, and now only a few are getting rotated in each day. And we came in with many suitcases filled with supplies. The folks coming in today can only bring in one bag of small personal items. So that, along with 14 months of systematic attacks on healthcare workers, over 1,000 reported dead, many more captured, kidnapped, and tortured, means that there are no supplies and also not enough people to really provide support to the medical system. And there's also, you know, people in Gaza, in particular with chronic conditions, have not been treated properly for over a year. And so beyond the emergent needs of, you know, of the results of violent attacks when people are running to the emergency room if they do survive for huge wound injuries and other traumatic trauma surgery needs, there's an entirely large group of people, including, you know, pregnant people, birthing people, young children, who are not receiving kind of that daily, the routine medical care that they need.
And Bridget, you addressed some of what it takes to get into Gaza as a doctor. I wanted to mention one news headline from overnight that I saw on Al Jazeera, which is that Israeli forces have arrested a Jordanian doctor whose name is Abdullah Al-Balawi, who was traveling with a relief delegation to the Gaza Strip. That was during the time that he was trying to cross the border again with a relief delegation. Dr. Sube, I'm wondering if you can describe what it takes, the actual process of getting into Gaza as a medical professional arriving to do basic medical care.
Yeah. So of all the humanitarian missions I've been on, getting into Gaza is the most difficult. There are so many hurdles to actually get in. You know, obviously, there's a handful of organizations that are allowed to provide services in Gaza, and that's determined by Israel. Secondly, you have to, after you're approved by the organization, you have to ensure that you're not of Palestinian heritage with a Palestinian ID. So many of our colleagues, well-trained, highly skilled, exceptional doctors here with a Palestinian ID cannot go and provide care there. Third, you get clearance, kind of a temporary clearance from the Israeli authorities to enter on a specific day. There's only 2 days that convoys are allowed to enter. Each convoy maybe brings in about 20 or so personnel. Of those, maybe there's like three or four physicians or healthcare workers. The rest are generally UN staff. Then at any time within the 24 hours prior to your deployment, you know, you have to fly into Jordan, Amman, Jordan. Within 24 hours of your deployment, they can revoke your clearance without reason. And they can tell you can't enter. So it is extremely difficult. There's a lot of uncertainty around it. And that's what I tell folks when they're trying to apply to go to Gaza is, even though you're blocking, you know, 6 weeks of your time to go there because you're required a minimum of 4 weeks now to serve on the ground, don't get your hopes high that you're going to be able to get in, because anything can change. They can just close, you know, they can decide, you know, they don't want to let you in for whatever reason. And so it was really unfortunate to hear this news of the surgeon who's been to Gaza before and has been vetted and cleared by the Israelis, to hear of this illegal detention without reason given to his family, and this kind of extension of the detention that Israel unfortunately uses against many of the Palestinians that are in detention. Over 10,000 are held hostage for decades in Israeli dungeons. And so I think this should wake up the kind of at least the humanitarian circle to the reality on the ground, if they're not already awake after 15, 16 months of genocide, to say, hey, you know, we have rules around our humanitarian principles and protection of our humanitarians as they go in. And so it's really distressing to see that, you know, they're acting with impunity, even against humanitarians that are going in there to help the civilian population.
That's right. Earlier, you mentioned that there are many hurdles to get into Gaza as a medical provider. There are also hurdles for some doctors once they return from the region. Bridget, after your return to the Bay Area, you faced repression at your regular job here in the Bay as a result of wearing a Palestine pin. You were, I believe, put on leave for insubordination for not removing the pin when asked. Where do those consequences stand now, and how are they impacting you?
Yeah, to clarify, it's not even really that clear of a Palestine pin. It was a watermelon that I wore on my badge. And the day after I got back from Gaza, to work from Gaza, I was placed on administrative leave for insubordination for not taking it off. I work at UCSF, and there is no dress code policy against wearing pins or things, special little things on your badge. It's kind of part of hospital and nursing culture to have little decorations when we're all wearing the same scrubs to differentiate ourselves. I was confused as to why I'd be asked to take off a watermelon pin and not the Black Lives Matter or LGBTQ pins that were also on my badge in support of other oppressed and marginalized populations that we support and that we try to signal to as healthcare workers that this is a safe place for them to be. That leave began in June, and I'm still on administrative leave and anticipate further punishment if I continue to return to work once invited back, if I'm invited back rather, and continue to wear the pin.
It's interesting that you mention the wearing of other pins that signal a version of solidarity with a group of people. We, a few weeks ago, had on a teacher, a former teacher from Bishop O'Dowd High School in Oakland, who was fired for the same thing, wearing a pin that I believe that pin actually did say Free Palestine, but that same person had previously been encouraged by the school administration to wear a Black Lives Matter pin. According to reports, though, people at the hospital made claims of feeling uncomfortable as a result of the pin that you wore. Discomfort seems like something of an arbitrary line to draw. I'm wondering what you make of those claims of discomfort from your wearing of a watermelon pin.
Yeah, I think that it's important to distinguish that discomfort is not a lack of safety. And it, you know, when during the kind of beginning of the Black Lives Matter movement, in my workplaces, I also, you know, experience patients being uncomfortable with my colleagues or I wearing Black Lives Matter pins. And the important reason why we continue to wear them is because Black Lives Matter is a public health issue. Particularly in my field, Black women are far more likely to have severe pregnancy complications and to die during pregnancy and childbirth than any other woman of any other race in this country. Black babies are more likely to die within their first year of life than any other babies of any other race in this country. It's clearly a public health issue that we have to stand up for as healthcare workers. The discomfort, especially in the context of me wearing these other pins, feels very clear to me that it is this Palestinian exceptionalism. UCSF itself manufactures its own pins for workers to wear that are in support, like Black Lives Matter pins and LGBTQ pins. It's very clear to me that, you know, this, there is an issue of anti-Arab and specifically anti-Palestinian racism that is happening and that is being supported. I think that UCSF's administration could say to people being could provide education to people being uncomfortable about what is going on, about the well over 200,000 people who have been killed around this actual genocide that is going on, and be supportive of the employees who are standing up and spreading the word about what is happening in Palestine. Moreover, there's many people who I work with, colleagues, doctors, nurses throughout the UCSF campuses who are wearing the same watermelon as me and are not being placed on administrative leave. It has turned into a very big thing over a very small watermelon for us. And it's just incredibly disappointing how little value our medical institutions have put on Palestinian lives, and how so many medical institutions, in particular UCSF, that purports itself as, you know, a not only an institution, but a medical school that's really committed to social justice, global health, and health equity, how they remain silent and complacent in the face of everything that has been going on for the last 14 months.
Dr. Sube, I want to bring you back into the conversation. I'm wondering if you've experienced any impacts or acknowledgments even at your regular job here in the Bay Area, responding to you going on these medical missions to Gaza and Lebanon that in the story we just heard from Bridget at UCSF became very politicized.
Yeah, I want to start off by saying sorry, Bridget, that you're going through this. It is definitely not easy, especially after having been witness to what's happening on the ground. And I think it's really a privilege to even say that I feel unsafe wearing with someone wearing a pin. It shows us how out of touch we are with the reality of people around the world that don't look like us or have our privileges. So I think it should encourage us to pause and think about all the privileges that we have, and realize that we're all very interconnected. I think it was October 2023 when I started speaking out more about what's happening in Palestine, not only in Gaza, but Palestine in general, and understanding, people just need to understand the history and the reality of living under occupation and military blockade and, you know, living in an apartheid system. Speaking out against that and speaking to the impact on people's health with fellow healthcare workers is when I started seeing a very big backlash within my professional society. I should say a very big backlash from a small group of very vocal people. It's largely speaking, most people are just ignorant about what's happening in Palestine, or were, and maybe are getting more educated nowadays. But unfortunately, there are people within leadership who are very vocal that, you know, sent me threats. You will never be able to work as an ER doc in the United States again. And again, I wasn't saying anything, you know, quote unquote controversial. I was literally talking about the healthcare impacts. You know, when I would post things about children I would take care of, and especially like what I would classify as miracle stories, being able to save a child's life while I was there on the ground, I would get a lot of mind-boggling messages from, again, physicians who have been in practice for decades, saying how anti-Semitic I was. I mean, I think it's like weaponizing this this term and really doing it doing a disjustice to the true anti-Semitism that is faced across the globe. And I continue to experience that. I would say, me personally in my local hospitals, I've gotten a lot of support, luckily. And I work with a great team. People check in on me, check in on my family. You know, doctors, nurses, administrative staff. So I've had a little bit of a different experience. And I think, you know, institutions like UCSF and especially a lot of the academic centers I've heard are, you know, I think folks that work there face a lot more hurdles than maybe community hospitals. But I think these institutions, as being really the models for how healthcare should be practiced, should be looking at, you know, what's working at community hospitals, where they are truly creating safe space for dialogue and for people to bring light to injustices happening not only domestically but abroad as they relate to public health. Because if it's not affecting each and every one of us right now, it should. If you're not thinking about what's happening in Palestine today, you really should, because it represents a breakdown of the entire international law, international humanitarian law structure, and the implementation of it, as it's been marketed to us for decades. And so I think we should be extremely concerned and thinking about it. We are not sheep. And I think that's important for the listeners to really internalize. We are not sheep. Like, this world cannot be controlled by a handful of people. We all should have a voice in how we want to create the world around us. And so, I learned over time not to worry too much about what people say or threaten me with. And but it does require, I think, a local leadership that's supportive and understands and advocates for, freedom and justice.
Thank you, Dr. Subay. We are about out of time, but Bridget, I wanted to bring you back into the conversation for a very brief reference point for the protest action that you participated in Sacramento over the weekend. Healthcare workers from the area created a visual exhibit to call on elected officials and healthcare leaders to listen to their constituents and do what they can to end the violence on healthcare infrastructure in Gaza. Can you very briefly tell us about the protest and describe the visual element and why you were there?
Yeah, there was a really beautiful action that happened on Saturday at the Capitol, where I spoke along with two of my colleagues who also have been healthcare workers who have been in Palestine in the last year. And this was a collaborative effort between Healthcare Workers for Palestine in Sacramento, which is an organizing group, and their sister organization that I'm a part of, Healthcare Workers for Palestine Bay Area. We are exhausted seeing what is happening to our colleagues and feel like we're kind of screaming into a void of how we keep calling upon our healthcare institutions and our communities really to understand what is going on, and our elected officials as well to stop arming Israel and stop allowing this genocide to happen. There was a really impactful visual die-in that happened along with report backs from the three healthcare workers who had been again in Gaza in the last year. And the main demands were that there is an immediate ceasefire, that there is a stopping to bombing of the hospitals and attacking of healthcare workers, both in Gaza and in Lebanon, a protection of the children in Gaza and Lebanon who are dying at such staggering rates, and a comprehensive and immediate arms embargo against Israel. You know, each day as we see this devastating news coming in from Gaza, as we are seeing these horrific images live streamed to our phone, as we are hearing about the ICC's issuing of Netanyahu's arrest warrant, as we are getting the Amnesty International report backs saying that this is clearly a genocide, we are also seeing our government locally and federally sending money to Israel, either, indirectly through investments, or directly through literal billion-dollar checks that are happening in weapons. And, you know, healthcare workers are very clear that as, you know, people of conscience and people who are, you know, took on the role to support all human beings, to do no harm, that we will continue to show up each day to continue fighting for an end to this genocide and for free Palestine.
Well, Bridget Rocios and Dr. Sube, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you both for your work and for joining us. And Bridget, I'm sending you best of luck in getting back to work after your administrative leave.
Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a world where all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA, that's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is co-hosted by me, Jesse Strauss, and Kat Brooks, and produced by me as well. Our show theme music is from Steve Raskin. Feel free to hit us up about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media. That's at lawanddis, and subscribe wherever you stream podcasts by searching for Law and Disorder with Kat Brooks. You can also find our content live on KPFA Radio or streaming at kpfa.org in the 8 a.m. Pacific hour, Mondays through Thursdays. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by listeners, and if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.